We're going to win so much, you may even get tired of winning. And you'll say, please, please, it's too much winning. We can't take it anymore. Mr. President, it's too much. And I'll say, no, it isn't. We have to keep winning. We have to win more. We're going to win more.
Welcome to Literary Hangover. I'm Matt Leck. With me, Chris Liao.
Hello.
And today we are doing Corey Robbins' The Reactionary Mind. This is more of a, it's more topical. We've gone out of chronology. We're no longer in the 17th century American colonial times. We're going to move to modern times. And I think one of the best books for understanding the coherence or lack thereof of the conservative, of conservatism, or as Corey Robbins calls it, the reactionary mind. This book is called The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Donald Trump. It's the second edition. The first edition was Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin. So the symptoms have just gotten that bit worse.
Well, I was going to say, before you get too far away from it, if you want to tie it to the chronology that you're going, you know, a lot of this framework that Corey Robbins establishes begins with the French Revolution, you know, in the turn of the, you know, the 18th century into the 19th yeah. century, and when Edmund Burke was writing, right, and sort of these pulsating forces of revolution and counter-revolution. So, you know, in a way, sort of philosophically, we can take it back to that time.
And especially when you think about, you know, all the talk Alex and I have had about, is Hawthorne a conservative? Yeah, in Robbins' estimation, conservatism begins with the French Revolution, which takes place after many of the books that we've talked about already. But
And I think it's important to think of conservatism as counter-revolution.
Yes. Right? That is why Chris and I will be focusing on the second chapter of The Reactionary Mind on counter-revolution, mainly. Because I think right now we're in a sort of late stage of counter-revolution. And that's not just my hypothesis. That's Corey Robbins, as we'll find out. Like I said, I think this book is really useful for looking into that. It doesn't only go into Edmund Burke and Sarah Palin or Donald Trump. Although the Trump chapter is very good too. It also goes into Nietzsche, into Friedrich Hayek.
Fukuyama gets a shout out.
Fukuyama does, yeah. I think Fukuyama is a bit more repentant than some of those other ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that is interesting. And
I'll go to bat for Nietzsche. Well, not for, you know, some of the quotes, but.
Yeah, exactly. The selective Nietzsche. I don't know. Nietzsche's pretty out there. Those labor quotes are pretty nuts. But we're not really covering that. Or the, did I mention Ayn Rand? Ayn Rand and Scalia, I think, are the two.
There's a big focus on Ayn Rand, yeah.
Yeah, I think those are the two he demolishes the best.
The book is a collection of essays, right? It's like, it's sort of front-loaded in him establishing this framework, you know, in the first couple of chapters. And it is remarkably useful. You know, people talk about Trump and sort of how much of an aberration he is, but once you see conservatism through this framework that Corey Robbins discusses, then, you know, a lot of it sounds exactly normal and exactly what you would expect.
Yeah, none of it should have been a surprise. And Corey Robbins is one of the people who comes up with hypotheses that I think a lot of people use to think about the world, I think, on Twitter and like writers, right?
They have to mention him. And that's how you know you're effective in sort of establishing this broad framework, because, you know, otherwise you feel like people in their op-eds would want to just, you know, not give credit to other people. But their fundamental assumption, you have to, you know, to understand where they're getting from, you have to understand this framework that Corey Robbins is putting out there. So mm-hmm. they can't help but mention it.
The most important thing I think he does is dispense with the notion that conservatism is a consistent thing throughout ages. And really what it is a tactical response to liberation movements, whether it's anti-slavery, feminism, what class, you know, redistribution, right. That's what it is.
And a defense of hierarchy.
Defense of hierarchy.
And the sense of loss, you know, someone losing. So in the French Revolution, right, you saw the overthrow of monarchy in France, and the rest of Europe was appalled. You know, everything else was a monarchy in Europe. And, you know, there were a number of coalitions amongst England and Germany and Russia and et cetera to come together and fight revolutionary France and force them to restore the monarchy. And so, you know, it was that sense of loss. Well, and it wasn't just monarchy. There was also religion, you know, that they got rid of in aristocracy in general. Mm-hmm. And sort of this like modern birthplace of this dynamic between progressivism and conservatism that we now know.
Yeah, and you get the image of Burke is very, you know, poor Marie Antoinette.
Talks about her dress or something, right?
Yeah, and how basically her decadence, the beauty is a sign of decadence, right. That sort of stuff. Interesting, like the close reading Robin does of these thinkers is very interesting. But some of you Majority Report listeners will no doubt be here because I promised that we would use this book to settle one of the raging debates that occurred on Majority Report this year in May. It's called the Zero Sum Debate, and 27-minute clip on YouTube if you want to check it out. I'm going to put it in the show notes. And I sort of agreed with Sam here, although I know where Michael and Jamie are, what they're being sensitive to. But let's play the debate a bit from it here, and then we can talk about it.
You're not talking about Jordan Peterson, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why they, you know, you were like, why do these white guys get so worked up about, you know, not, like, the, you know, another white guy who can't speak on a college campus, or just kind of like these small things.
Dude,
that were
I
like,
got news for you. I'm a white guy.
Yeah.
I'm a white guy. And I grew up around a lot of people like this who take issue with, you know, the hippie dippies on the campuses who are speaking out. And I know I am fully, fully aware of the attitudes that that drive this sense of like, I can't talk anymore. I can't say certain things about certain people. People get too sensitive. I know a lot of people like that. Most of the people I grew up with were like that. So it's not a mystery to me where this comes from. I get it. I totally get it. I think at the heart of it, frankly, it is people feeling like they are losing their status in society. And guess what? They are. They are. This is a zero-sum game. If you have had an inordinate amount of status as a function of something that has nothing to do with you, but has to do with the subjugation of other people who might be competing against you, broadly speaking, it's not true for every single individual, but broadly speaking, you're going to lose your status when they start getting more more opportunity and more voice in society. That's just the reality of it.
Well, it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game, though. Like, I think that's what
when it comes to social status,
bit,
it right? has to be.
I mean, status is so intimately tied to economics that, like,
it's not just
the goal
that.
Of a lot of leftist thought right now is how do we get people to become left populists?
I get that. But the fact of the matter is that every bit of our culture was centered around one specific group of people. And that was not just an economic calculation. It just so happened that those people had the power. So they're going to lose that status. There's just no denying it. It is a zero-sum game.
But why do people feel the need to have a special status in the first place?
Because human beings, I think, like to feel that they are special. And human beings don't like to lose what they have.
It's kind of
the same
thing. You got to be careful. You do have to be careful.
Hold on.
You do have to be careful.
Same thing as saying no one's going to give up power, right? No one's going to give up power.
Well, actually, people,
because status translates into power.
Well, actually, no. People have actually. I mean, like if you look at the negotiation of apartheid, people did voluntarily give up power.
All right. Wait a second. But
no. Let me just finish. I just want to say.
No. Wait a second. They didn't give up.
They literally did. Yes.
Without threat.
No, of course there was threat. That's part of the process. Absolutely. But they also did end up peacefully negotiating it. So I'm just saying I just think
in
general.
They didn't want to, but they did.
Well, no, by the 80s, actually, people like de Klerk did. They saw the bigger picture. But the thing is I would just be careful of, especially when we're on the left, of kind of naturalizing that sort of thing. Because as soon as we're in the like, human beings are X in terms of a desire for a certain thing, we're in Peterson territory.
No, I don't think so. I think it's very hard for some people, not all people, but the people that we're talking about, obviously, the idea of losing their status. They don't like the idea that they have to press, you know, one to speak English. Okay? And that runs the gamut. Wealthy people, poor people, middle income people. That runs the gamut. They don't like having to, there's resent.
All right, Chris, you are an outside observer. What is your reaction to that clip?
Well, you know, so I absolutely agree with Sam's characterization, you know, about loss. And, you know, there's a quote that immediately comes to mind that I, you know, I don't remember the attribution and I'm paraphrasing, but it's, you know, to those with privilege, equality feels like oppression. And, you know, in the book, Corey Robin quotes Andrew Sullivan. He says, all conservatism begins with loss. You know, and then Robin goes on to say, so the aim of conservatism isn't preservation or protection, but recovery and restoration. You know, I think it's obvious that Sam has read, you know, Corey Robin's book.
Yeah. Yeah. Corey Robin's been on Majority Report a number of times. I think we're having him on again soon.
Oh, and I was going to say too, but at the same time, you know, Michael does make a point about just the term, the phrase zero sum, and how that can stoke this anxiety. And I'm sympathetic to that a bit. I understand that. So.
Yeah, I think Jamie's reacting to that too. I think they're being a bit oversensitive to it. Well, basically, I think there's two different category slippages that are occurring that are making this disagreement, because I think a lot of the disagreements we've had on Majority Report are basically just people not quite agreeing on terms, but continuing forth anyway. But first is, I think Sam's making a diagnostic argument about just the reality of what happens when you make society more equal, what happens to the people who it was unequal in benefit of. And Jamie and Michael are making prescriptive arguments based on, let's not lead with that, right? Like, let's not lead with, you're not going to be able to do this. And I understand that, but I also think from a political reality standpoint, or just understanding reality, there is a slice of people who, unless they're very, very, like, what's that guy, the billionaire Hanauer?
Yeah.
Like, they're not going to go against
the one who argues for more fair taxes.
Yeah, yeah.
Progressive.
The so-called good billionaire or whatever. Generally, that's not going to happen. Like, you shouldn't expect that. And actually, I think Jamie hits on why she should agree that it's more complicated and sort of is a zero-sum game when she says status is tied to economics. Because because that means economics is tied to status. And if you start changing people's status around, then you're going to start changing economics around. And people are going to feel that as a zero-sum relationship. And then Michael, I think, is sensitive to the biological sort of determinism that it sounds like Sam's making. But I don't know that, like, human beings like power over others. And I think that I understand why those sorts of arguments people are concerning to people. But I think they're sort of just historically demonstrable. And you already mentioned part of it, but let's get to part of the part of the reactionary mind that addresses this specific question. This is again from chapter 2 on counter-revolution.
His constituency is the contingently dispossessed, William Graham Sumner's forgotten man, rather than the preternaturally oppressed. Far from diminishing his appeal, this brand of victimhood endows the conservative complaint with a more universal significance. It connects his disinheritance to an experience we all share, namely loss, and threads the strands of that experience into an ideology promising that that loss, or at least some portion of it, can be made whole. People who aren't conservative often fail to realize this, but conservatism really does speak to and for people who have lost something. It may be a landed estate, or the privileges of white skin, the unquestioned authority of a husband, or the untrammeled rights of a factory owner. The loss may be as material as money, or as ethereal as a sense of standing. It may be a loss of something that was never legitimately owned in the first place. It may, when compared with what the conservative retains, be small. Even so, it is a loss, and nothing is ever so cherished as that which we no longer possess. It used to be one of the great virtues of the left that it alone understood the often zero-sum nature of politics, where the gains of one class necessarily entail the losses of another. But as that sense of conflict diminishes on the left, it has fallen to the right to remind voters that there really are losers in politics, and that it is they, and only they, who speak for them. All conservatism begins with loss, Andrew Sullivan rightly notes, which makes conservatism not the party of order, as Mill and others have claimed, but the party of the loser. The chief aim of the loser is not, and indeed cannot be, preservation or protection. It is recovery and restoration. That is one of the secrets of conservatism's success. For all of its demotic frisson and ideological grandiosity, for all of its insistence upon triumph and will, movement and mobilization, conservatism can be an ultimately pedestrian affair. Because his losses are recent, the right agitates against reform in real time, not millennia after the fact, the conservative can credibly claim to his constituency, indeed to the polity at large, that his goals are practical and achievable. He merely seeks to regain what is his, and the fact that he once had it, indeed probably had it for some time, suggests that he is capable of possessing it again. It is not an old structure, as Burke declared of Jacobin France, but a recent wrong that the conservative addresses himself to.
So yeah, I think Corey Robin directly addresses there, and why I always sort of bought Sam's side of the argument fundamentally, because I think we are, for most people, it's going to be better. And I think that's the fundamental thing the left needs to keep a focus on. That, like, say you're all of a sudden women are going to be less preyed upon in the workplace. But, dude, you're going to not have to worry about that pre-existing condition making you bankrupt from medical debt. But on the other hand, there are going to be people who don't have that pre-existing condition, who just have a lot of money, and they're going to be like, what the fuck do you offer me? And it's going to be not a lot.
Right.
Like, the left can't help Bill Gates, right? Like, I mean, I sometimes think the left can help Elon Musk because I think he's putting too much on his plate, but, and maybe that's the way you phrase it. Like, you think you want all that responsibility, but it's crushing you. But again, like, I do think at some point, there are going to be certain people on the right that we're just going to have to say, they're not us. And we have to beat them.
Right. Corey Robbins' framework, right? This revolutionary and counter-revolutionary forces being progressive and conservatism. You know, it's you see that play out right now with things, right? So if, you know, we had a black president, you know, much quicker than most people, most of white America was ever expecting, you know, the gay rights issue evolved. There's a chart, you know, that maybe we, you know, I can find at one point, but it talks about, it somehow graphs its progress. And it
when
was
Obama
just,
went public?
The gay rights movement in general.
In states.
And how quickly that issue was won historically compared to other issues. And then so as well, and then the Me Too movement, which has caught fire, you know, and so Corey Robin, I mean, within that framework, so if that's the revolutionary force, you get this counter-revolutionary force, and that would be Trump now talking about this war on men, right? And he talks about how the conservative, he says something about, you know, the conservative forces are always the best students of the left, and they use and repurpose their vernacular in terms. Mm-hmm. So it's the same, you know, they try and adjust to this new reality of empowerment, but they use it in a way to justify the pre-existing hierarchy and power structure.
Yeah, Tucker Carlson, who we're going to get to now, is a master at that. And by that, I mean being a sort of fascist appropriator of leftist language. That's what Tucker Carlson is. And we're going to play a couple of clips from him first. But first, I want to play this part about we are in a moment of counter-revolution. And counter-revolution is where the right realizes that a hierarchy is not maintained naturally. It has to be done with human agency, and no one is going to do it but them. And this is, I think, the most interesting and dangerous part of conservatism, and I think it's the part we are getting smacked in the face with every single day today. That this is why if people wonder why Republicans are acting so psychopathic, answer number one is they're psychopaths. But answer number two is they need to now because they understand the reality of popular democracy and the force behind it. And even if they gerrymander and do all this stuff to make institutional democracy in America a relative sham, they're only doing that because they have to.
Well, and as you mentioned, we are in a period of counter-revolutionary. Like this, we're coming off a 40-year period of conservatism, right?
Yep.
And so we're in late-stage conservatism, if you will, or late-stage counter-revolutionary in Robin parlance.
Yep.
And so that's why it's getting more egregious, right? Trump is in the same tradition of that, but it's sort of like the late stage, you know, scorched earth version.
And that's one of the ideas I think Corey Robin is most known for is that, and we're going to touch on this more explicitly later, but that Republicans are sort of out of wins, easy wins, because they've been winning for so long. Here is where we're going to talk about when the right starts appropriating the left language because they realize they're really in trouble. Here's Corey Robin again from the chapter on revolution.
Our most salutary and most beautiful institutions yield nothing but dust and smut. What these two opening statements of the conservative persuasion suggest is that the greatest enemy of the old regime is neither the revolutionary nor the reformer. Instead, it is the old regime itself. Or, to be more precise, the defenders of the old regime. They simply lack the ideological wherewithal to press the cause of the old regime with the requisite vigor, clarity, and purpose. As Burke declared of George Grenville, in the very different context of Britain's relationship with its American colonies, but it may be truly said that men too much conversant in office are rarely minds of remarkable enlargement. Persons who are nurtured in office do admirably well as long as things go on in their common order. But when the high roads are broken up, and the waters out, when a new and troubled scene is opened, and the file affords no precedent, then it is that a greater knowledge of mankind, and a far more extensive comprehension of things, is requisite than ever office gave, or than office can ever give. Later conservatives will make this claim in various ways. Sometimes they'll accuse the defenders of the old regime of having been cowed by the revolutionary or reformist challenge. According to Thomas Dew, one of the earliest and most aggressive apologists for American slavery, the Nat Turner Rebellion destroyed all feeling of security and confidence among the master class. So frightened were they that reason was almost banished from the mind. It wasn't just the slaves' violence that frightened them. It was also the moral indictment leveled by the slaves and the abolitionists, which had somehow insinuated itself into the slaveholders' minds and made them unsure of their own position. We ourselves, wrote William Harper, another defender of slavery, have in some measure pleaded guilty to the impeachment. More than a century later, Barry Goldwater would take up the same theme. The very first paragraph of The Conscience of a Conservative directs its fire not at liberals or Democrats or even the welfare state. It is aimed at the moral timidity of what will later be called the Republican establishment. I have been much concerned that so many people today with conservative instincts feel compelled to apologize for them, or if not to apologize directly, to qualify their commitment in a way that amounts to breastfeeding.
So let's go right from that to Tucker Carlson. A couple different clips from recent days. He's been going crazy lately. This is him on Nike.
At a press conference saying, I'm not going to Vietnam. That's a lot different.
Well, this is a hapless kid. That's what we're forgetting. And that's why I don't think we should take Colin Kaepernick as seriously as we take the people around Colin Kaepernick, the sinister figures in this, again, who are profiting from attacking the country in its most basic symbol. So what happens over time if your ruling class decides to attack the very system that made their lives possible? Everything falls apart. You can't. So that's why we should actually be worried about this. It's bigger than just one football player.
All right, and exhibit two.
You know what they're not doing? And this is what troubles me, and this is what my book is about. They're not protecting their own voters. Democrats wake up, and they're like, we're representing people who voted for us because
okay.
They want something specific. In their case, power. Mm-hmm. Republicans are representing people who are reviled by almost everyone who actually has power. They're hated. The middle class is hated. And they're not standing up for and defending their own people. What is that? And by people, by the way, I'm talking about a socioeconomic class. I'm not talking about an ethnic group or immigrants versus non-immigrants, any of that identity politics garbage. I'm talking about people in the center of our economy. And those people are hated by everyone in Hollywood and everyone in finance, and the Republicans should be their protectors, and they're not.
All right. A few things on that second clip there. The idea that the Republicans represent the middle class and that the middle class is at the center of the economy? Like, what are you talking about?
Well, that's exactly Corey Robin, him adopting that populism, right? He had a phrase, it was like reactionary populism, you know, so where you assume that identity, yet his party and the Republican base is, you know, largely represents the 1%. So in a way, what he was saying, you know, about, you know, he labeled some, you know, liberal group celebrities and et cetera, but they are actually, you know, statistically part of the 1%, right. You know? So it is, there is a class war against the middle class. That's exactly right. That's that revolutionary terminology that he's adopting, yet he's using it in a way to preserve the existing hierarchy of the 1%.
Yeah, and again, and then secondly, the idea that he is talking about a socioeconomic group is belied by the fact that Tucker Carlson doesn't talk about any fucking thing besides immigration. Right? He's a guy that does segments on gypsies in Pennsylvania. He's a racist, and you should take him seriously because I don't think in the history of our time there's been a media company that has done as much wide... Well, I guess it's tough because AM radio is pretty bad in America too, but literally both AM radio and Fox News, I think, dwarf anything of like the Nazis propaganda outfit. Like, just in terms of raw numbers, right? Like,
well, even in the recent years, it's just gotten even more blatant with Fox News, right? Where they're, how many members of Trump's cabinet are former Fox News officials, right?
Yeah.
And he would tweet about upcoming programming, like, oh, you know, so-and-so is going to do a story on this, you know, make sure you watch. It's like, why does the president of the United States know what Fox News is going to air before anyone else?
Yeah, so let's move on to a few different things. You know, the measure of a book, and we've sort of hinted on this with the way Corey Robin is talked about it, and his sort of theories are talked about at large as his. And the measure of a book in my isn't just the book. It's also the type of media appearances that this person does and the type of reviews it gets and the type of basically the type of cultural output that it prompts. So with all this in mind, we both follow Corey Robin on Facebook. Is that right?
Yeah.
He's one of the better Facebook intellectuals. He's very good on it, and he's very good at applying sort of his analysis to real-time events. And I wanted to kind of give you a taste of that in two of his sort of more provocative conjectures, which is that the GOP is somewhat impotent at the moment, and that the reason for that is they have been, and this is maybe less controversial, that they've just been winning so much that there's nothing left to win yet. So here is Corey Robin from April 17th, 2018. This is at... the Harvard Law Forum, Trump and the GOP seem to be taking a surprising amount of L's lately, or during his whole entire term.
Regardless of what that president does. So I would like to take a different track, tack, and focus not so much on what Trump and the right say, at least in this first part of this talk, but on what they spend. Joseph Schumpeter, the great economist, once wrote, "The spirit of a people, its social structure, all this and more is written in its fiscal history." That's the budget, in other words. Its fiscal history stripped of all phrases. He who knows how to listen to its message here discerns the thunder of world history, end quote. In a budget, in other words, you see what a country, or in this case, the conservative movement, and its elected officials really think and are able, capable of doing. Whether they are willing to put their money where their mouth is. So what is the message, the thunder of world history, that we see in this budget that was recently passed, I think less than a month ago, about 3 weeks ago? According to The Atlantic, this is a, quote, "domestic budget to make Barack Obama proud," end quote. We are here in a university, so let's start with the things that universities care most about themselves. Trump and the conservatives in Congress wanted to radically cut funding for the National Science Foundation and the National Institute of Health. They also wanted to eliminate completely the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. In this budget that they just passed and that Trump just signed, Congress increased funding for all four agencies. Trump wanted to cut funding for Pell Grants and Head Start. Congress increased funding for both. Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, wanted to cut the budget of the DOE, which conservatives, remember, since Reagan, have wanted to completely eliminate, just get rid of it. She wanted to cut that budget by $9 billion. Congress increased that budget by nearly $3 billion, higher than the levels that even Obama funded it as. Let's turn to immigration, a subject around which many on the left and liberals have a great deal of legitimate and justifiable concern. A lot of the attention in the immigration debate and politics has focused on the wall that Trump wants to build. Trump and the hard right Republicans wanted $25 billion for the wall. He got $1 billion in change, almost all of it expressly earmarked for repairs on existing barriers and what's called secondary fencing. In other words, very little devoted to any new fencing. Trump was so pissed about this that the first thing he did was to call for the military to pay for the wall out of its own budget. That's not happening. And now he's made this move to bring the National Guard in to head for the border. Interestingly, at levels and numbers that are lower than what George W. Bush did in his administration. Like those executive orders that I talked about earlier, both of these responses of Trump's are examples not of presidential power, but of presidential weakness. Unable to get his program through Congress, he's left to bluster on Twitter. But the real story about immigration and the budget, I think, lies elsewhere. As Dara Lind recently reported in Vox, Trump wanted money for more than 1,000 new ICE agents. Congress cut that request back to 100, none of which of those agents are going to be allowed to be engaged in anything like arrest or detainment. Congress also put very tight financial restrictions on how many immigrants ICE can hold at any one time. And Trump and the hard right, remember, wanted to deny funding to sanctuary cities. Congress refused to go along with it. Trump wanted to cut funding to Planned Parenthood. Congress refused to make any cuts to Planned Parenthood. Trump wanted to cut funding to the EPA by 31%. Congress refused to make any cuts to the EPA. I want to make sure we go through all of this because I think there's a very powerful sense that people have of the power of these people. And I think it's important to kind of look at some of these hard material realities. Trump wanted to cut funding for renewable energy by 65%. Congress increased funding for renewable energy by 14%. Trump wanted to cut funding for the Health and Human Services budget. Congress increased it by almost 20% to almost exactly what Obama had asked for in his last budget. According to Politico, this is a budget that, quote, not only protects Obama's priorities, it expands them. It does far less for Trump's stated priorities.
Obama probably should have had some bigger priorities, but
priorities. Now, remember, after the passage of the tax cuts late last year, so this would have been November, December, the word from Paul Ryan and the Republicans was, you know, great. We're just going around second base. We're headed for third, and we're going to go home. And what they meant by that was we're going to now gut the entitlement state and get rid of the liberal welfare state. None of that has happened. And that's part of the reason, of course, why Paul Ryan is retiring. So what this really means is that we're going to get close to the end of Trump's second year in office with 2 years of budgets that look remarkably like those of Barack Obama. So, whether we are taking the measure of the right by public opinion polls, by the electoral results since Trump's election, by the policy record, by the resilience of the movement's apparatus and its para apparatus, or the basic ability of Trump and the right to transform in their favor the dominant assumptions of the political conversation, the way Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush did, I think we'd have to say that the right is doing remarkably badly. And I say remarkably badly because if I had told you in the immediate aftermath of the 2016 election that any of this was likely to happen when all anyone could see was that Trump and the Republicans were firmly in control of all the elected branches of government, you would have said that I was crazy. And I know this is so because I did say a lot of this at the time, and you, or at least a lot of my readers, whoever they are, did say that I was crazy. But I think the fact of the matter is, if you look at Trump in historical perspective, compare him to the presidencies of George W. Bush, Ronald Reagan, or even Richard Nixon, and when I say compare them, I'm not talking about who's the worst person, who's the worst, the more radical right-wing. I'm just saying in terms of their ability to execute the basic agenda that they're elected to office to execute. The fact of the matter is they are doing remarkably badly in comparison.
I think that that is a very seductive argument. And the problem I'm sort of wary of it is because it is a bit of a bedtime story.
Yeah.
Like things aren't quite as bad as they could be sort of thing.
You know, there's some truth to it, but also, right, I mean, there's plenty of holes in the thought. Like, you know, especially when they talk about, and they compare it to hit the budget proposal, that's always a wish list, you know, and Donald Trump is ever the gambler, right? And he's going to be dramatic and his stated premise of creating chaos or whatever.
Right.
Like, or just trolling them, like, you know. So it wouldn't surprise, you know, when he phrases it like that, it sounds like it might be a huge loss, but like, did he ever really intend to win that?
Well, the thing is with the budget fights in general is, yeah, we're getting budget signed and theoretically that's a sign of things working properly, but that's also a sign of the Republicans aren't the opposition party anymore. And the Democrats are a more responsible party. That's the thing is they haven't been able to really go at entitlements. Kevin Cramer is running against Heidi Heitkamp saying he's the one that's going to protect Medicare, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was thinking about that, so there hasn't been a big push yet, but look, we've just had two of the largest tax cuts in history, like consecutively, basically, and, you know, escalating in size. And, you know, that's a time bomb. So it's one thing to do it, you know, on a budgetary outlook on what you're spending. But at the same time, they're slashing, they're just gutting the revenues, you know. And I guess those are all projections. I guess you could just turn around and raise taxes and maybe, you know, maybe there's some assumption, you know, on the, in, amongst the elites or the conservatives that these don't last forever. But
I mean, that'd be a smart money on their part because they can't. Like,
right.
And I mean, I do think tax rates are basically a huge part of the fight. You need to just slam high rates. To the point where there's not really billionaires anymore.
Right.
But yeah, but the other thing is, you know, a lot of their moves, they're not terribly forward. They're not the Paul Ryan, we're going to like privatize Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they try to sniff at that stuff though. But it's defensive. It's judiciary, right? So you pack the judges because now we have Brett fucking Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court for 40 years.
Right.
And they can just swat shit down.
So we are in this, you know, we're at the tail end. We're in late stage conservatism, right? Or anti-revolutionary, conservative era that began in the 70s. And this is the tail end of it. And that's why it appears so egregious, right? And it's sort of this scorched earth. And that's why the optics of Donald Trump, you know, are what they are, you know, because the party is relatively weak. And so someone like that could come over and just take over. And, you know, this is their, you know, clinching on their way out, basically. And they're trying to pack the courts, the Supreme Court and everything lower as well. You know, all these egregious, multiple largest tax cuts in history consecutively. And then it's just, you know, doing everything they can, right, to profit up before they inevitably lose.
Right. And this is where the part of this Harvard thing where Robin sort of counts why there's really not much left for them to win. Or in Trump's word, why they're sick of winning.
I think the reason why the Republicans are having such a hard time of it, despite being in control of all three elected branches of government, despite having so many states under Republican control, is that to a very large degree, conservatism has succeeded as a project. And it is that success that has made not just Trump, but conservatism and the Republican Party vulnerable. Remember how I defined conservatism earlier in this talk as a movement of reaction against an emancipatory movement of the left that seeks to empower the lower classes to speak and act on their behalf, to act as independent agents of their own destiny. Modern conservatism began as a movement first against the emancipation of the working classes, by modern I mean 20th century conservatism, a movement against the emancipation of the working classes, then against the emancipation of African Americans, and finally against the emancipation of women. Conservatism didn't simply seek to stop the emancipation of those groups, it sought to stop those groups from seeking their own emancipation. Conservatism, in other words, is a counter-movement to defeat a movement. And I think for the most part, conservatism has succeeded in doing that. Certainly the labor movement, to all intents and purposes, has been defeated by the right. But I would also say that despite the victories in representation, electoral representation of African Americans, the movement, the Black Freedom Movement and its goals as they were set out in the 1950s and 60s, has been significantly set back, if not defeated. Residential and school segregation, which was, of course, the original animating purpose of the Black freedom struggle, is worse today than it was under Ronald Reagan. The right to vote, the other pillar of the civil rights movement, is under assault in many states. The racial wealth gap today is larger than it's been in decades. But more important, despite the rise of Black Lives Matter, whose fate remains uncertain, the movement of Black citizens, the movement of Black freedom, seems to have been stalled for some time. And as for women, conservatives have had a somewhat, I think, tougher time there, but even so, women remain very much on the defensive. So overall, if we think of these various struggles, labor, African Americans, and women, as movements rather than simply as policy achievements, and I think this is, especially places like law schools, these things get talked about as sort of policy goals and so forth. But I think you, from the conservative point of view, you have to think of these as movements. It's safe to say that conservatism, at least for the last half century, has had the bulk of the momentum on its side. But having won so many victories, its raison d'etre is now very much in doubt. Without an emancipatory left, a left that is genuinely seeking and potentially succeeding in dispossessing people of their power, the right's arguments and reasoning seem increasingly hollow.
And yeah, I think that's really the nub of it. The thing about Trump winning is that when I read the first edition of that of Corey Robbins' book, to me it felt like the Republicans are done and Sarah Palin was the end of it, right? Like, this has run its course, clearly. I don't think it's a course that needed to have been run, but it has been run.
And its life arguably extended through, gerrymandering and super PACs and the inequality and the political representation that can buy. Right.
Right. One of the most interesting and haunting quotes to me is by John Mitchell, who was the attorney general under Nixon. His wife was, it's pretty, I don't even have time to go into it, but John Mitchell. And he told a reporter, here's from his obituary, to a reporter, "This country is going so far to the right you won't recognize it." And what haunts that to me is I want to know what he knew, right? I want to know why he knew that.
And that was at the onset of this current conservative era that's now hopefully ending at some point soon.
and there's another thing where there's Jimmy Carter's talking about, "I'm so great because I ran the state house of Georgia like a lean corporation," and sort of that was the signal that the Democrats are neoliberals now too, right?
Right.
And I don't blame, I want to get out of the moralizing frame of neoliberalism, and I want to understand it historically, and I want to understand why that was the headwinds people just decided to dive into, because it was clearly so pronounced that the world entered this corporate stage, and And it wasn't just because people are sellouts, right? Like, that's part of it. That's they did that. But why? What was the material circumstances that led them to do that? To me, I guess Corey Robin focuses on, you know, the anti women's liberation, anti gay things of but he also talks about some of the more interesting chapters are the stuff where he talks about Hayek and how
there's an economic component there.
The man of business becomes the sort of warrior, right?
Right.
And all that stuff is, I think, reaction and the way humans reacted to material reality, and that's what fascinates me. And
yeah, you know, you mentioned Carter, and shortly after the election, Corey Robin compared Donald Trump to Jimmy Carter, which sounds ridiculous on its face.
And you know, especially temperamentally,
right? So, but what he was saying is that, you know, they're both the late stage. Jimmy Carter was the late stage of this this progressive era.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you saw him morph and sort of become more conservative. And sort of Donald Trump now, you know, at this late stage of where we're at, and sort of, you know, all these losses, you know, that the Republican Party is taking, that Corey Robin was talking about.
Robin has also talked about Nixon as sort of why Nixon acted like, you know, the EPA is incredibly progressive legislation that happened without and I think this is right. If it's not, somebody, one of our political people should let me know. But I don't think there was significant public pressure to start the EPA. That was like a technocratic thing that Nixon did, or the Nixon White House. And, you know, that was because the overall sort of deep state, if we want to use that overused term by people like Sean Hannity, but like the state overall, which is much more than the White House, obviously, which includes not only government but also even the corporations that make up the country at a time, right?
Right.
They were more liberal, and they were a type of liberal, right? A pre-corporate, pre-Reagan type liberalism.
This post-war, right?
That's
the only reason that these interests, you know, kind of that their interests align, right? The interests of the elites and the government. And that's why the top tax rates, you know, post-war went up to 90%, you know, and then you can sort of map, you know, the decline of that, the end of that progressive era with the fall of those top tax rates almost.
Yeah. And so now it's, you know, the trouble with Robin's theory is he predicts an end, but it's not sure when it's going to get here, especially on a human time scale. Like, what's going to happen to the Republican Party? Well, they're going to be in the judiciary for a while.
If tax rates are anything to go by, they, you know, they're super, super fucking low right now.
The war chests. I mean, the war chests. That's what people have to start thinking about this as. When the Republicans cut taxes to corporations, they're giving those corporations money to go to war against people, as far as I can. That's the way I think about it.
It buys political influence.
And that's why you see this intellectual dark web bullshit. I don't know if you've noticed it, but there's this like hoax thing going around where some people like submitted some studies to social science journals and got in, and they were like, oh, this disproves social science, this disproves race and gender theories, right? Which number one is bullshit, because if you really want to criticize those, critique the leading fucking research in those fields. Don't, like, the fact that one thing can get through peer review is not impressive. One studies
the platform versus, right, the content.
First of all, that's not even a disapproval of peer review. Bad shit gets through peer review all the time. It doesn't get reproduced, though. Reproducibility is a huge part of the scientific process. It's not just one study. That people are just fucking idiots that don't understand what they're talking about. But bigger, they're showing their bias because they want to destroy those departments. They want to get rid of race and gender theory. They think they're all kiboshed. I'm going to read from this fucking ex-leftist, that Brett Weinstein. He's been on Bill Maher. He's this dipshit. Anyway, let me go off on him for a little bit. Okay, so Brett fucking Weinstein tweets out, There is a way that the academy's meltdown is karmic. Students have been maleducated in gender and race studies all along. That should have been enough, but most academics are timid and busy, and so this intellectual infection was foolishly allowed to fester. Oppression is real. If you want to help the oppressed, educate them. Don't induce them to obsess about injustice. Arm them to escape it. They want to defund those. This is what I'm talking about. You know, you need to just look at dollars. And actually, Robin quoting Schumpeter is very interesting there, because that is how you need to think of it. The conservatives see the public money going to departments like that, and they know that, okay, look at this, and they want to pretend like it's all this bullshit based on like your personal lived experience and that stuff. A lot of stuff about systemic inequality and shit comes out of that, like gender gaps, income gaps. You look at just capital in general. There's a study that came out that said only white millennials were pro-capitalism. Every other one is like 48, 42, socialism over capitalism. Hmm. And it's obvious because the whites are capitalized. And
at the expense of the government, historically, oftentimes.
Obviously. Trump, did you read the Trump story?
Yeah. Do you have the New York Times piece.
Yeah, did you actually read it?
It was really long, not the full thing. But
I sat down last night and read the full 14, thing.
All 14,000 words.
I sat down here, was watching some baseball and just listened. Actually, I put it in an audiobook app and just listened to it. That's how you got to do this, people. Do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, I mean, it's sort of like part of it is not surprising whatsoever, mm-hmm. you know, but then it's...
You saw the Fred Trump angle, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so it was really interesting to see the relationship with the father. Of course, you know, so that was huge. It kind of reminded me of Inception, you know, and he just like wants his daddy's approval and stuff. And so, you know, there's that aspect. But at the same point, it's like, I don't think that, you know... At the same point, this does nothing to him, I feel like, you know, politically. But it is just sort of crazy to actually see how it works.
To how tawdry capitalism is.
Right.
Like, Fred Trump, basically, to summarize, had basically been using political connections to get a bunch of low-interest loans from the government to build up housing units. And then he would make so-called capital improvements that would look much more impressive on the invoice than they would the actual, improvements made to the apartments. And then all of a sudden the value is going up and you just rake in a huge sums of money that way. And then Trump, man, I remember you used to live on the Upper East Side, Trump Palace.
Yeah.
Trump Palace is up there.
I used to have to grocery shop in that thing.
I remember walking past that all the time. I'll just pull a little nut, and I'm going to go back to the Ayn Rand thing because this is relevant. We're going to go back to using more Corey Robin after this. But so here is how Trump got his shares in Trump Palace. This is just from one of the thousands of paragraphs in this story. But anybody who wants to understand capitalists, and I think people say capitalism too often. I want to say capitalists because we need to personify these people. Should read this story and how this shit is done, because there is no doubt Trump may be the most egregious or one of the most flamboyant of the people who do this, but it's not that he has the most genius tax people that, right? Like this is what happens.
This is how easily available it is.
Yeah. Yeah. So under IRS rules, selling shares worth of $15.5 million to your son for $10,000 is tantamount to giving him a $15.49 million taxable gift. Fred Trump reported no such gift. According to tax experts, the only circumstance that would not have required Fred Trump to report a gift was if Trump Palace had been effectively bankrupt when he unloaded his shares. Yet Trump Palace was far from bankrupt. Property records show that condo sales there were brisk in 1991. Trump Palace sold 57 condos for $52 million. So even that $15.49 million gift, that gift is you can make a whole bunch of money on these condos, right? Mm-hmm. Trump Palace sold 57 condos for $52.4 million, 94% of the total asking price for those units. Donald Trump himself proclaimed the palace the most financially secure condominium on the market today. In advertisements he placed in 1991. I mean,
Yeah, you know, that's, and you, but you could still make it seem, you know, not profitable. And there's like, when they were talking about his estate toward the end of Fred's life, they just created these shell companies to basically sell good, you know, push goods back and forth at inflated prices, you know, and as, and that's how you illegally, you know, launder money basically back and forth. Like, you know, I'm going to charge you 10 times what this thing is worth. It's just an excuse for you to hand me some money.
Right.
And they did that, you know, at Trump's casino in Atlantic City, right? He needed some money. And so Fred had someone go in and buy $5 million or whatever it was worth of chips and then didn't gamble at all. So it was just like giving him $5 million. And so he's able to make a bond payment that, you know, the next day.
Right. And there's another, if you search poker chips, Donald Trump, Fred Trump, there's a great New Jersey newspaper story in there for you. I mean, this stuff has been, we've known this stuff.
That part was out, for a while.
We've known all this stuff, but this New York Times thing, and you should not give your money to the New York Times. Give your money to a more local or an independent news outlet. The New York Times is going to be fine.
Unless you live in New York, then you don't have any much more or less local.
Even then, go somewhere else. Like, you don't, it's pointless. You're wasting your time. I mean, unless you like to have the physical paper. I understand some people are like that. But this gives me an opportunity to go to the Ayn Rand chapter, where Ayn Rand and Hitler are compared. I think you can compare all these people. They're all in a spectrum. And I think it bears a lot. I was thinking about it a lot when I was listening to that Trump story. So here is...
finds his deepest calling in economic activity. Okay. Far from demonstrating individual and the collective. Rand thought the former an existential fundament. The latter, whether it took the form of a class, race, or nation, a moral monstrosity. And where Goebbels talked of violence and war, Rand spoke of commerce and trade, production and economy. But fascism is hardly hostile to the heroic individual. That individual, moreover, often finds his deepest calling in economic activity. Far from demonstrating a divergence from fascism, Rand's economic writings register its presence indelibly. Here is Hitler speaking to a group of industrialists in Dusseldorf in 1932. "You maintain, gentlemen, that the German economy must be constructed on the basis of private property. Now, such a conception of private property can only be maintained in practice if it in some way appears to have a logical foundation. This conception must derive its ethical justification from the insight that this is what nature dictates. Rand, too, believes that capitalism is vulnerable to attack because it lacks a philosophical base. If it is to survive, it must be rationally justified. We must begin at the beginning with nature itself. In order to sustain its life, every living species has to follow a certain course of action required by its nature. Because reason is man's means of survival, nature dictates that men prosper or fail, survive or perish, in proportion to the degree of their rationality. Notice the slippage between success and failure and life and death. Capitalism is the one system that acknowledges and incorporates this dictate of nature. It is the basic metaphysical fact of man's nature, the connection between his survival and his use of reason, that capitalism recognizes and protects. Like Hitler, Rand finds in nature, in man's struggle for survival, a logical foundation for capitalism. Far from privileging the collective over the individual, or subsuming the latter under the former, Hitler believed that it was the strength and power of individual personality that determined the economic and cultural fate of the race and nation. Here he is in 1933 addressing another group of industrialists. Everything positive, good, and valuable that has been achieved in the world in the field of economics or culture is solely attributable to the importance of personality. All the worldly goods we possess we owe to the struggle of the select few. And here is Rand in Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, 1967. The exceptional men, the innovators, the intellectual giants, it is the members of this exceptional minority who lift the whole of a free society to the level of their own achievements, while rising further and ever further.
So yeah, we know that that's...
So I thought you were going to play the clip where, since we were just talking about Trump and the way him and Junior and Senior sort of milk the system, you know, and how at odds that is with their public persona, you know, the Corey Robin had a bit when he was talking about Ayn Rand and how she benefited first, you know, in Russia, like from the revolution, because that opened schools up women and Jews.
Right.
And then like she went to all these like public arts performances that were put on, you know, provided by the liberal state.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, and later in life, I don't know if he mentioned this, but I know she accepted, she took like Medicare, Medicaid type Social Security handouts or something like that.
Right. And Robin makes a point that I think is flawed. He makes a point that Ayn Rand is, all her books are about this genius that's misunderstood by but a few elite. But how does that mesh with being a sort of author where you're getting readership, a wide readership? And she is actually very popular. Like Brad Pitt, unfortunately, is a fan. Like there's,
and Angelina Jolie. He had all sorts of quotes from Hollywood celebrities. But it makes sense if you are an elite, you know, economic status, that would appeal to you.
Yeah. The problem, the one thing is she wasn't actually that wide read at the time. Her popularity was inorganic. I think in Dark Money, maybe, she talks about the Koch brothers buying up in bulk copies of Ayn Rand books. Hmm. The one funny thing that my favorite thing of all time, like I remember getting the internet in the mid-2000s, and you would, you know, you'd think of it as your portal to knowledge, so self-improvement. So you'd search things like the greatest books of all time. If you go to modern libraries, I think they did it in year 2000, 100 best novels. Ayn Rand's are in there. They're not good. Alex and I think are planning on covering at least one Ayn Rand novel. But the funny thing about it is the reader's list. The number one novel of all time is Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, 1957. The number two is Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead. But the funniest thing is that number three is L. Ron Hubbard's Battlefield Earth. So like this was clearly just a bunch of nerds and literally cultists. Because we know Scientology is a cult. L. Ron Hubbard has two more entries in the top 10. Mission Earth and Fear. I can't.
I guess if you start a religion, that's pretty good for book sales.
It's not bad.
Look what that did for the Bible.
Ayn Rand has four. Ayn Rand has two more. Anthem and We the Living. I mean, it's a complete joke, but that's always been very funny to me. That, I think that had an effect. I think that that list had a large cultural effect, and I think that's how we will. The other entries, Lord of the Rings is number four, To Kill a Mockingbird number five, and 1984 number six. So I think
school curricula for some of those, and a bunch of nerds for the top spots.
Imagine if you were a teacher and you didn't know anything about books. You're like, okay, what am I going to get these kids to read? Let's just get the top 10 modern library books. That's probably what Brad Pitt did. Anyway, Chris, thank you very much for joining me again this week.
Always a pleasure.
Check out, let's plug some things. Patreon.com/literary hangover. Also on YouTube, if you subscribe to things on YouTube, subscribe to Literary Hangover on YouTube. We also have a newsletter. Chris, do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, the newsletter is called Infoer, and it comes out every Sunday. It's good. It's a newsletter for the new Gilded Age, and it's not going to be talking about stuff that it's been covered wall to wall on TV or whatever it may be. So it's
visually stimulating.
Yeah, there's lots of charts. It's nice. So, and just quotes and bold. It's like pretty easy to just glean some information. So, you can go to facebook.com/informationer, and sign up there. What else? Oh, we're on Twitter, at Infoer, INFOER_.
All right. And, do you want to plug your,
sure. Yeah. I'm at,
I can just put them in the,
in the notes show notes. Too. That's fine.
All right. Patrons, I'm going to put out the rest of Hope Leslie volume one, soon, probably this weekend. And, I want to narrate the rest of the book, in the next week or two, I want to get that out to you so Alex and Grace and I can record on it. So look forward to that. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it's because you're not a patron. I am narrating an audiobook, and I'm going to probably give away the first couple chapters to the public show feed just so you can get a taste. And I must say I'm really interested. I'm really enjoying the process of narrating a book out loud.
It's going to be scandalous. There's some naughty words in there.
Oh no, not this one. That's a different one. Oh. Yeah. George Lepard's The Quaker City. I'm going to have to say the N word a couple times, which I didn't quite bank on when I decided I wanted to read that, but I do want to read that. And I do kind of think principally you have to narrate the book as it is. And I wouldn't do it if I didn't think George Lepard wasn't probably good on, even race issues. I think he's a generally egalitarian guy, and I think he was good on race issues. If it turns out that that's not the case, I might not be narrating that entire book. But I think he was a good guy, so I think it's important to actually reproduce this book faithfully, even though has me reading characters Twain does this, characters that speak in Ebonics. It's not fun to read out loud, I found. But no, Hope Leslie doesn't have that word in it, thankfully. So I'm just going to soar through narrating that. I'm really enjoying it. I listen to a lot of audiobooks. I've always said the best way to take in a book is to have the book in front of you, but also have a narrator reading it to sort of sensory overload yourself. But I will say, narrating one out loud is a different sort of beast. Because you're putting all the lines of dialogue in your mouth, like you're definitely not skipping over anything there, and it's just psychologically, I'm really enjoying it. So patreon.com/literaryhangover if you want to listen to me read Hope Leslie, and we will see you soon.